I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nickturn on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/be-here-now for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn on May 28th.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi everyone, it's Raghu Marcus, and this is Ram Dass Here and Now. Got a great podcast this week. Ram Dass hangs out with a couple of his very close friends and co-teachers, Roshi Joan Halifax, who many of you know because she does guest podcasts on the Be Here Now network, and Frank Ostaseski, who Ram Dass has taught with over many, many years, especially in the area of death and dying and working with people who are at end of life. And today, the discussion revolves around some of the concepts from Frank's book. He has a new book, which is really quite fantastic, and it's called The Five Invitations. And it's really an examination of how death offers a path to radical transformation. And I really believe, so some of the invitations are, don't wait before you start to enter into an inner dialogue around dealing with the transitions in life. Welcome everything and push nothing away. Bring your whole self to the experience. Find a place of rest in the middle of things and cultivate a don't know mind. Now, all of these things really can inform our life at every stage. And that a lot of what certainly part of the conversation does revolve around, these concepts are highly useful to us, not just in the case of facing death, illness, and so on. So a really important book, and it's a fantastic conversation that I think is super important, again, across all stages of life, not just you got to think, okay, I'm over 50, 60 or whatever, so now I can start thinking about this stuff. I think if you start thinking of it in your 20s and 30s, because it informs how you deal with life on a day-to-day basis. So these are great, great concepts. Now, this gives me the opportunity to talk about support for the Be Here Now Network, because we have Frank's book. So it reminds me, hey, get in there and go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and bookmark our Amazon link and then put it in your bookmark browser. So whenever you need to buy anything from Amazon, you just go automatically click onto the browser and you pull up your normal, what Amazon looks like. You can get anything from your refrigerator to your air conditioner to your music. And for me, to my supplements, I get a lot of supplements on Amazon, and they deliver, as you know, very quickly. We get a few percent of whatever you buy as a result of our affiliate code that's in that link. That's why we need you to bookmark it and go through it every time. And that goes a long way to supporting what we're doing here at Be Here Now Network. And things have expanded, and I think you've noticed that. More teachers, more content, the Heart-Mind app, which is providing a great platform for people to have instant access off their phones to all of these podcasts and videos. And I mean, it's a lot, and there's a lot of people involved. So I know that this is very much like an ad, but we don't do ads, at least not yet. We might have some PBS kind of sponsor stuff going to happen, I hope, in the future, because we really do need the support. But right now, it's all about you guys. And if it's not Amazon because you're not interested in buying stuff, well, then just go to the donate button, support button link on Be Here Now Network. And gee, a $9 a month, nine is multiplier to 108, the guru number. So nine is the sacred number. If you can do nine a month for the next year, that will go a long way to really helping us out. And it's helping us out, and of course, supporting all the people that work and all of the different platforms that we need to be able to run the network, and as well as sharing where we can with the teachers so that helps them in their journey. It's pretty tough to get in what you need as a teacher, aside from the books. And look at Krishan Das. He's out there almost on a nightly basis, working. We'd love to see, him get some passive income. And of course, Ram Dass, who no longer travel and teach, and so on. That sounds like a real sob story, but it's reality. So please consider it, will you? And the first thing to do is just get something that's going to help you out, which is Frank's book, The Five Invitations. Okay, go to Amazon and buy that book. We hope that you will continue, because we have gotten some support for the network, and that's why I'm making a bit of a big deal, because we need a lot more. So this is Ram Dass Here and Now with Roshi Joan Halifax and Frank Ostiseski, having a wonderful conversation around his new book, The Five Invitations. See you next week on Ram Dass Here and Now. Hi, everyone. This is Ram Dass Here and Now, and I'm Raghu Marcus. And Ram Dass is got some real big time Here and Now people with him today to talk about. The subject is going to be death and dying, but in such a way as we are going to be led through it by Frank Ostiseski. And Frank just wrote this wonderful new book, The Five Invitations, and we're going to talk about them. And we got Roshi Joan Halifax as well, who just happened to be visiting for a moment, right? And you're just going to come and hang with us and do this thing. So we caught her unaware, so to speak. Not really, but. And Ram Dass. So hi, everybody. Say hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Great to be with you all. Thanks for everyone for doing this. It's really fun to be together.
Oh, and Frank, I just have to congratulate you. You got the book done. And it's, and I'm so, I'm thrilled. I think it's just amazing. I know it was literally a labor of love. Mm. And death.
It was love and death, yeah. It was that, and I'm really glad it's done. And now, hopefully, it'll serve a few people.
Absolutely. But the beauty in it, Frank, is how much of you really is in this in terms of so many incredible stories. I mean, Roshi, you were just saying you were in the car listening right to the audio thing, and you just get completely absorbed from one story to the next. So it's just, and of course, and the honesty in it is spectacular. So the five invitations are Don't Wait, by the way. Don't Wait, Welcome Everything, Push Away Nothing, Bring Your Whole Self to the Experience, and Find a Place of Rest in the Middle of Things, and Cultivate a Don't Know Mind. All really, really wonderful. I love the characterizations that you've put together here. Okay, so we're just going to get right into it. And right at the beginning of the first thing in the book, of the first invitation, is this little thing from Sogyal Rinpoche. I've got to read it. Whatever we have done with our lives makes us what we are when we die. And everything, absolutely everything, counts. That's a scary thing when you really read that and you go, oh, geez, yeah. And it's as well, it's also a real kick in the ass about not waiting. Waiting till you're at the point at which you don't even have, the big thing, of course, is you don't have a chance when your body is infirm to do the kind of practices that are necessary to get you into a balanced frame when you actually approach transition. But can you talk a little bit about this Sogyal thing that you put in there? Because I think it's terrific.
Frank. Well, it's a beautiful quote. It's a beautiful quote by Sogyal, of course. And what I like about it is everything matters, not just the big things. The little things matter too. So that also gives us reminds us that even those small acts of generosity or of kindness that we offer, they matter also. They contribute to the whole. Yeah. So I think that that's a really important thing. But, you know, how it relates to Don't Wait is that, as you suggest, Raghu, waiting for the moment of dying, you know, imagining then that we will have the physical strength, the emotional stability, the mental clarity to do the work of a lifetime is an absurd gamble, just absurd. Yeah. And so we have to practice now. We have to live our lives now, not just to prepare for dying, but because this is what we've got. We've got this life right here, right now.
Yeah. Why is it such a tough thing for, I mean, I can remember, you know, we went to India and I was really young, many of us were, and I can remember not paying any mind whatsoever, even knowing the concepts, to the idea that I would be facing a transition that I was unprepared for. So it's very difficult, right, to get anybody's attention on this. And I think it would be a great thing to talk about. One of the ways in which to get people's attention, I think, is the idea that you do whatever work you do to get you more friendly with transition, however, and more friendly with Roshi. You've talked about the mystery a lot in the past. whatever that informs every moment of your life. I don't care if you're, you know, 21 years old or if you're 71 years old. So can you guys, Rosie, why don't you talk a little bit about how practices can around a transition, this transition, inform other parts of your life and parts of your life that and when you were, you know, much younger.
You know, I'm recalling some lines from the Rilke book, Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, that goes, love and death are the great gifts that are given to us. Mostly they are passed on unopened. Mm-hmm. Love and death are the great gifts that are given to us. Mostly they are passed on unopened. So I think for me, the practice, you know, when Frank talks about, you know, it's a gamble, I think it's actually a gamble to wait. I think it's actually not even a gamble. I think it's a catastrophe. So that in a certain way, there's an imperative that we live to open the gifts of love and death, Eros and Thanatos, and to take this moment, you know, to come to terms with the truth of impermanence, how completely fragile our relationship to life is, to this body is, and that this moment that we're in right here, in this experience, as, you know, we're being listened to or viewed by others, it's gone like a flash of lightning, like a bubble on the stream. It's just flash and out. So the practice for me is really about being in this a radical state of present moment mind, this very moment mind, this very moment heart. And, you know, sometimes this very moment mind and heart is kind of lazy, like, you know, we're sitting here in Maui and I'm, you know, all of a sudden I've come down thousands of feet in altitude and I feel my sloth nature arising. Well, good. I will just be, you know, a little slothful for a while. But it doesn't, no matter how lazy or sick or impaired, how much suffering, how much theater is going on in our political world. And boy, is there a lot, you know, the states of distraction we can enter in our present political theater. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. As you would say, yum, 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 yum. you know, this makes John Carré, Le Carré, look like, you know, kind of fluffball. But anyway, it's like, don't be distracted. Be right here in this moment. That's the practice. I love what our mutual friend Sharon says. You know, she's always saying, begin again. And yeah. So, you know, we're always kind of falling off the wagon moment after moment. And then we recollect. We remember why we're here. We remember who we really are. We remember this moment because it's gone immediately. And that, for me, is the practice of love and death that Rilke wrote about in that book. But I'm also remembering another quote from the Mahabharata that goes something like, Yudhisthira was asked, what is the most wondrous thing in the world? And he replied, the most wondrous thing in the world is that all around us, people are dying and we don't realize it will happen to us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, hey, yeah. So in the background of our mortality, you know, just holding that space of the truth of mortality, boy, is that a kick in the, you know, to really appreciate this life, even when circumstances are incredibly difficult. To see if we can also roll that into our practice.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think, Baba? I'm asking your opinion. He's being shy.
I think you sadhana, and the sadhana is like the dying process. The sadhana brings you to the moment. Wow.
So, Baba, yesterday you were talking with Noah and me about being here in Maui, and also, you know, this body kind of dropping away, but the spirit and love expanding. I'd love to hear more about, you know, what you were sharing yesterday. It was just so powerful about the current state that you're in.
Current state of mind.
Who are you?
My body is 85 or 86. I watch it all with fascination. I'm in here with, I'm watching time go by. And being in a Maui, I feel content. And this is first when I got here, content. And that brings me here. This content here, every moment. A moment is not in time. A moment is delving deep within the moment. And that's where that mystery is.
Beautiful.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and I think that the reflection on death can help us discover what you're speaking about, Ram Dass. You know, that death is, you know, inevitable and intimate in our lives, but the reflection on it, the contemplation of it, causes us to be much more present, doesn't it? You know,
yeah.
To be here with it. It reminds us not to waste time, to really step in fully, you know, to jump in with both feet, I say, to this moment, what you're describing. And that's why it's such a life-affirming practice, I think, to reflect on dying, to contemplate it dying. Not, again, to prepare for some moment at the end of a long road, but to be right here, right now.
Yeah, and that makes it absolutely pertinent to everybody, not just seniors. And I think that's a major point, that this is what I meant when I said before, or asked the question, how that's exactly how it can enhance our life and inform our lives, these practices around this. And another thing, Frank, you said, you talked about, while we mostly associate impermanence with sadness and endings, it's not all about loss. In Buddhism, impermanence is often referred to as the law of change and becoming. That's a great thing. These two correlated principles.
Beautiful way of saying it.
Yeah,
right?
I love it. Provide balance and harmony. Just as there is constant dissolving, there is also constant becoming. I mean, this is, to me, a gigantic thing for all of us, for people to absorb. And I think goes a long way to taking some of the sting away from the fear of change and impermanence. We rely on impermanence, you said. The cold you have today won't last forever. This boring dinner party will come to an end. Evil dictatorships crumble. You didn't say when. Yeah. Replaced by. Replaced
by.
Should
have heard our breakfast conversation.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Replaced by thriving democracies. Even ancient trees burned down so that new ones can be born. Without impermanence, life simply could not be.
Right.
Really
right.
Great.
You know, a few days ago, I was in New York, and I was with a dear friend, being with her, who her husband died 3 days before. He was 58 years old. He was an eminent physician, remarkable guy. He had the whole of Columbia Presbyterian supporting him. But now he was dead. And her basic question to me was, where is he? How can I relate to him? Is it just an end? Is it a full stop? You know? And she said, tell me what's true. And I said, well, I can't tell you what's true. You have to decide this. You have to understand for yourself what's true. I said, but let me ask you a question. When you look around and you walk in nature, when a tree falls in the woods, doesn't it become something else? Yeah. I said, do you know anything different in your life? You know? And so what I was trying to encourage her to look at is kind of what Ram Dass was pointing us to, which is that, you know, we don't know how it's going to turn out. It wouldn't be an adventure if we knew how it was going to turn out. You know? That's why it's a mystery. And the mystery invites us into that kind of open-ended inquiry, a kind of discovery, yeah? You know, these people were great adventurers. And I said, you know, your whole life has been built around adventure. This is the new adventure. This is the legacy of your husband's death, is to now understand for yourself what's true for you. Don't take anybody else's word for this. Discover what's true for you, you know? And to do that, you have to love the truth. You have to really love the truth. You know, it's like, I use the image of when you go to a mountain lake, you got to love the lake, right? I mean, Roshi's out there climbing around all the time in her place, you know? You got to love the view from the ridgetop. But it's not enough to love the lake or love the view. You got to love the walk up the mountain. Because otherwise, mosquitoes come out, you will turn back, you know? When it gets hard, you will turn back, you know? So in this life of practice that we engage in, we have to love the process. We have to love the practice, in a way. That's what reveals the truth to us, you know? It's not like some religion has the corner market on truth, you know. And we're discovering it. It's always unfolding right in front of us. And so I think that's what being with dying shows us. Roshi's been with, you know, in this work for as long as I have, much longer, in fact. That's what it shows us, you know. Moment to moment, truth reveals itself. Moment to moment, we begin to understand, yeah.
One of the things that you also talk about in the book is how illness opens us to a deeper dimension of being. And I think this is something good to discuss a little bit because everybody experiences that and it becomes another way in to practice. And but Ram Dass, I think it'd be great if you talked about, you know, I mean, you've dealt with this stroke for 20 years. It has caused all kinds of physical problems. And you do talk about how in the very beginning, and I'm sure all through these years, that you were driven, if maybe not the right word, but you were certainly led to what you call new planes of consciousness. And I think that's, to me, similar to deeper dimensions of being. Can you talk, Ram Dass, about how you approached these new planes of consciousness and that the illnesses and the pain and the suffering basically prompted them?
Well, the stroke put me in the hospital. And the hospital, full of friends and family and doctors and so on, they were all have long faces that stroke, terrible even, a head stroke. And I got rid of them. And I was in the bed, and somebody put up a picture of Maharaji. And I looked at the picture, I said, you know, I had a stroke. You didn't do anything about it. I said, were you out to lunch? And he said, he smiled in the picture, by the way. He smiled. He said, you want grace? Grace was coming down the road, coming down the road. And I, after the while, I couldn't do anything I used to do. I used to drive my sports car and play my cello, drive my airplane. And everything I couldn't do that out there, because my stroke, I was left right side paralysis. So I decided Maharaji made me decide. I got, instead of going outside for things, I get inside. And inside, wow. Wow. And I said, that was grace. That was grace. Because I was now getting on with my spiritual practice. Because the stroke. Yeah. It was grace.
Ram Dass, in the course of illness, particularly long-term illness, there's a kind of stripping away process, stripping away of our identity, stripping away of our roles, as you suggest. But when people are in this limbo state in between, it doesn't feel very pleasant. You know, when I've lost contact with everything that I've known myself to be, and I've not yet found myself to be something deeper and more essential, I can feel like I'm in a no man's land. And I wonder, I know that you had a little bit of that. And I wonder what was like in the no man's land. This is a place where people get very scared.
Well, people get scared because they want control. Mm-hmm. They want control. And they can't control this.
Yeah, so people want control. They want to be able to manage this experience, which of course is totally unmanageable. Death is not manageable.
Yeah.
And it's curious to me that we keep trying to give it over to medicine and have medicine manage this experience, which is too big, too profound to be managed by any one model, most especially medicine. Yeah. So yeah, I'm always interested in it. And maybe Roshi, you have something else about this in-between world where people get scared. They, you know, one identity is slipping away, an essential identity isn't yet present for them. What do you find there, Roshi?
Yeah, I think this is, I don't know what I find, but I think this kind of fear of when the ego is dissolving and also all of the roles that have reified the sense of self are suddenly taken away from you. Like R.D. was saying, you know, you can't cook, clean, you can't fly your plane, you can't drive your sports car, the cello is gone. And then who am I without these props that are all aspects of the ego? And then one of the practices that we do in Zen is we actually ask that question, who am I?
Yeah.
And we go back to it again and again and again. Who am I? Who am I? Every answer that comes up is a lie. And we have a lot of lying going on right now, but, and it's pretty interesting. Every manifestation that gives some kind of color to the self, some kind of structure to the self, is a trap.
Yeah.
It's a layer that's being, you know, laid by the ego to keep us small. And when we're in that transition, and I feel like so often when I've been here hanging out with RD, and I see him gazing out the window, I know that this small self is being liberated all the time. You know, really, every exhale. Yesterday, when we got here, just hanging out with him, I was just had the feeling that there's a kind of increase of his freedom through not only the stroke, but the process of aging. Mm-hmm. But it's really scary because we have propped ourselves up with so much structure and so much identity that suddenly it's kind of like we've leaped off the 10,000 foot pole or the 100 foot pole. And it's like, woo. Mm. Well, yeah. I think it's helpful to explore this kind of letting go before suddenly your legs get knocked out from under you, you know, through being really sick or in the process of dying.
Yeah.
I think that's what sadhana is about, practice is about.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, you know, it's like, this is not a romance. This is the real work that about dealing with our egos. Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys know this better than I do. I just sit there and shake on my cushion.
When I'm looking out at the ocean and there's clouds and just being there, being with those things, and I'm starting to do the work that you say, the work with my mind. And the work proceeds, and then I get breakthrough. And where I'm the ocean and the cloud, they're all together one. It gets fascinating, really. Fascinating. Yeah. I'm a bhakti yogi, so this can be done by love.
Yeah.
By love. Love things, love people, love. My wheelchair, love. It's all love. Because every time you love something, you bring it closer.
Yeah.
That closeness is one. Is one.
In my experience, Ram Dass, interest is not enough. You know, the interest in transformation is not sufficient. That, at least in my own experience, I've needed love as the kind of fuel for that journey.
Yeah. If
you, yeah.
You know,
there's
Frank,
a part in the. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Robert.
No, no, just because you're sparking something in me that I've been thinking about for the last few minutes as we've been talking. And then I guess it's about when Roshi talked about the letting go process, and Ram Dass is talking about that as well, and connecting with that love inside ourselves, connecting us with everything around us. And I know I've sat with you, Ram Dass, in that room, in that next to you, in that chair you're in right now. And then I myself recently have been going through pain stuff. And there's one part in your book, Frank, where you talk about pain plus resistance equals suffering. And when we talk about letting go, I think we all have a resistance in one way or another that gets, and certainly with pain, it gets exacerbated big time. So I'd like you all to take on how to deal with that in a practical way, because that jumping to where you can be in that ocean of love, as Ram Dass has jumped into, it took, you know, it's been many years of a process for you from the point at which you had that stroke. And for many people, that's the resistance to anything like that, and the resistances that happen in their lives make it very, very difficult to break through. So any advice at this point would be welcomed.
Well, I'm not so big on advice, but I can speak from my own experience a little bit. I mean, this is, first of all, we want to make this distinction between the love that RD was talking about and the kind of clinging and attachment that we frequently, that the cheap imitation of that love, right? That manifests sometimes looking like love. There's a story in the book that I like a lot. It's this guy, Carl. He was a kind of grandfather figure to me. He used to wear this gray sweater with leather buttons. I like it very much. I still have it. And he was a philosopher. And so he wanted to learn how to use mindfulness meditation to work with his pain. And he had severe stomach pain. So he had a morphine pump, but he asked me if I'd teach him to meditate. So I did in a typical way that we normally do, which is to draw our attention into the various sensations of the experience, the pain. But when we did this, it was too much for him. He was just screaming in a lot of pain, you know, like that. And so I said, let's try something else. So I put my hands on his belly and I said, how's this? And he said, oh, it hurts too much. So I pulled my hands a little further away. And I said, how's that? And he said, oh, that's a little better. I said, okay, I'm going to pull my hands really far away now. How's that? And he said, oh, that's lovely. That's what he said to me. That's lovely. Now, I didn't do any California woo-woo stuff. There was no Reiki or special energy work happening. We were just making room for the pain, right? So he said, that's lovely. And I said, well, could you rest there? And he said, out of his mouth, he said, rest in love. Rest in love. Yeah? It was beautiful. So then from then on, whenever he'd get in pain, he'd push his morphine pump and say to himself, rest in love, rest in love. I remember his wife came to visit him the next day, and she was quite anxious and nervous. And he just leaned over through the bed rails and reached his hand out and put his hand on her knee and said, oh, darling, just rest in love, rest in love. So I think that the way he worked with the pain is not, sometimes we can go with like a kind of laser attention to the pain and we can find the spaciousness that way. But other times we can give the pain space to move. And when we give anything room, it becomes workable, right? Mm. When we give anything space to move, it becomes workable. And so I think it's those are two ways to work with physical pain. Give it space or zero in, come very precisely into it and let it open in that way. But again, I think the motivation here has to be not rejection, but love and welcoming.
There's another great story, Frank. You should tell this, actually. It's about, and this goes to the, it's one of the chapters in the books, Don't Be a Role, Be a Soul.
Yeah.
I heard somebody say that recently.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That's familiar to me.
Yes.
Me too.
But can you tell that story of being with your friend John, who was dying of AIDS? Just, it's just... the way in which the honesty of dealing with something like that and then playing a role until you both felt, I mean, it's a fabulous story, please.
Well, Ram Dass knows this guy, so we can, this was years ago during the epidemic. John was a longtime Buddhist practitioner, and there were three or four of us taking care of him, I think. And the one, my day to take care of him, I arrived at his house and he was very confused. And one morning, he'd lost his ability to stand or to hold a fork or to speak an intelligent word. It was all happening one morning. I mean, it was devastating. And I remember sitting across the kitchen table from him, which was always a little bit chaotic in John's house. And I thought to myself, where has my friend gone? He was just there, just the other night, you know? And so we went through the course of a day, looking after him and taking good care of him as best we could. But, I'm a little ashamed to admit it, but I was really caught in my role. And it shifted. I mean, I was paternalistic at times. I was, the knowledgeable one, et cetera, John had these anal fistulas, like little tumors, and constant diarrhea. So taking care of him was a lot of work. And we would move from the toilet to the bath and back to the toilet, dozens and dozens of times. And, the evening rolled into the early hours of the morning, and I was tired, and I just wanted my friend to go to bed and go to sleep, to wake up in the morning, and somehow have this nightmare be over, So I had him sitting on the toilet with his pajamas down around his ankles, and I'm washing my hands in the bathroom sink, and I look in the vanity mirror, and I can see him behind me, mouthing to me. Now, he hasn't spoken a word all day, but I turn around and he whispers to me, "You are trying too hard." And I was trying much too hard to be something. Me, Mr. Hospice, And yeah. I sat down beside the toilet and I just started to weep. And it was the most intimate moment of our whole friendship, of our whole relationship. That moment sitting there, shit everywhere, both of us crying. Him sitting on the toilet and me next to it. Now, up until that point, I'd been afraid to enter into that territory of helplessness. I was afraid if I went in there, I'd get lost, Now, I didn't get lost. I went into that territory and there we were completely helpless together for a while. No separation between us, really. And this, we didn't stay stuck there. The situation showed us what to do next, But we couldn't have seen that until I was willing to go into that territory with him, to enter that territory of helplessness, I was standing on the outside. I was trying to be somebody. I was caught in my role. I was, trying to be the helper. And sure enough, reality just, when you fight against reality, you always lose, right? Reality just pulls right into it. And it was so intimate, Roger. It was so incredibly intimate. So I think that this is true for a lot of us, who do this work, and particularly it's rampant in the healthcare field, People getting stuck in their expertise and in their role. It's good to have expertise. Yeah. I like having tools. I got a whole toolbox full of tools. But I don't set it down between myself and the patient. One of us is sure to trip over it, So I don't lead with my tools. I don't lead with my tools. I lead with my humanity, right? And then if I need a tool, I can reach there in my back pocket and get it. But bad. I don't want to walk in the room with my tools in front of me. Yeah.
Mm. Beautiful.
Yeah. So. Beautiful. Yeah.
Great story.
I'm sure we've all had one like that as well.
To be open to our humanity, I think, is all through this book, and your openness to to that humanity, and the foibles of it as well is terrific, Frank. It's wonderful. There's another.
Well, not more from my mistakes. I imagine other people will learn from my mistakes too. Yeah.
I like this also this concept that you bring your whole self to the experience. How do we cultivate our essential nature without sidestepping our human nature, right? And I think we're talking, Roshi, maybe you can comment a little bit about that. I think getting at essential nature, but not just throwing out. We're human. I like our friend Jack Kornfield. It's okay to be human. It's okay. But how can we get those two things operating in a little bit more unison in our lives?
Well, I've been trying for decades, and I think I've been not entirely successful. You know, my feeling about this, Frank and Raghu and RD, is that the kind of every day, every inhale, it gives us the opportunity to begin a new day, to start again. And that if I were just pure Buddha nature, like, for example, a glass of spring water without a twist of lime in it, it's the twist of lime that helps us appreciate the water, if you will. It's, or, you know, we cook up boil water and we then pour it over tea. And it's the tea that has us turning toward water. So I feel like our suffering is a kind of doorway, or the substantiality of this lived experience is a kind of invitation for us to open to this a much wider vista. And again, I had such a beautiful time with RD yesterday talking together about this process of maturation, so to speak, and realizing, you know, he's got about 12 years on me. So he's kind of blazing the trail for all of us on how to meet life and death. And partly it's what both you, Frank, and what RD, both of you guys, what you were saying of, you know, it is this process of letting go. If we're granted another day, or if we're granted another decade, there's some kind of letting go process that is characterized, you know, as Brother David said, by surprise. You know, there's this kind of, wow, I woke up this morning. Wow, I could sit at 4 a.m. this morning and listen to the rain as I did meditation. The blessing of having some capacity still to serve people. I think about RD, you know, with his heart-to-heart encounters, or you, Frank, and Raghu, always conjuring ways to let the word of goodness move out into a world that is so imperiled. And I think that we align behind a sense of love, and also values related to respect and integrity, and use this life as an instrument of goodness. But the other side of the equation is that we're constantly falling off the edge. We're constantly learning from the incredible difficulties that we encounter. And I'm actually grateful to hold a loving space for my own difficulties, and also for the difficulties of others, to realize that this is how character is built. It's built by not resisting the the great, you know, kind of cataclysms that we encounter, but actually opening toward suffering with a heart that is characterized by love, but also the other word for me is by courage. It's the courage to, you know, take one step after another. I mean, you know, again, thinking about yesterday in our long conversation in the afternoon, you know, how Ram Dass keeps showing up, keeps offering the teachings, keeps that heart opening so that he can do the work of healing in the world. And I look at, you know, what you all are doing in the same vein. It is kind of the Bodhisattva imperative. Mm. Yeah. Anyway, sorry for the rave. But you know how it is.
And in talking about what you're talking about, and Frank, in the book, there's one passage. We don't have adequate language to describe this sort of incomprehensible experience, so we name it mystery with a capital M. Over the years, I have found that when we can experience or know directly what we can experience or know directly may be much more important than our ability to explain or measure it. What becomes undeniable when we sit with people who are dying is that fragility and impermanence are in the nature of life. It's always coming together and falling apart. Not just the physical properties of life, and not just at the time of death. And it is possible to hold it all in love and compassion. Yeah. Ram Dass, maybe you could talk a little bit about holding it all, holding the mystery in love and compassion.
It's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. It's so very beautiful. The aches and pains of the body I love them. And they're tricky.
Thank you.
They're tricky. In my sadhana, I reached soul land. Soul land. Wow. Soul land means everything. Love in both ways. And in the soul, you have the Atman, which is the one, the guru, and you, the wisdom of the one. I decided I can stay here with the perceptions of my soul. I can't stay here with identification with my body. That's going to be fragile. But my identification with my soul, then I'm sitting bedside, I see the its ego is in the first part and soul in the second part. And then if I just have identified with my soul, then I go with the person in to the end of the ceremony. Maharaji said, Ram Dass, love everybody and tell the truth. And that's important when your guru gets a mirror. There's no question about it. But I said, Maharaji, I can't do that. I was identifying with my ego. He said, all right, come back. We'll talk about it later. Later he came into me and, Ram Dass, love everybody. Just love everybody. I watched this, I can't, Maharaji. I saw that. That is a mind place. And my sadhana from there on, how to get to love everybody and tell the truth. Getting in the plane of consciousness, which I call soul land. When I'm in the soul land, I have no fear of death. No fear of death. No fear of death. Here I am with a body that's falling apart. No fear of death. My God. Everybody's coming in. You have fear of death. Oh. Has no fear of death.
In soul land, there is no fear of death.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
That's the bottom line. And Frank, in this book, you really do a heck of a job getting us to soul land. Really, it's right.
Beautiful.
Yes.
It's really something. And by the way, everybody, it is out there. It's called The Five Invitations, Frank Ostaseski. You can look at the Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com to Ram Dass Here and Now, and there will be a page up with this wonderful podcast, video podcast, webcast, whatever we're doing. And you will find all of the links that you need to, and also be in touch. Frank, you have a wonderful website as well. Mm-hmm. And we're going to put that up there. You tell us what it is, though, so people can go to it immediately.
Fiveinvitations.com. Easy. Fiveinvitations.com.
Okay, that's really great. So people do take advantage of that and do get the book. In fact, go to Amazon and our portal link so that we get a few shekels whenever you buy Frank's book from being an affiliate with Amazon. We love Amazon. Hey, thank you, guys. This was a wonderful experience.
Raghu, thank you.
It's really great. And thanks, Frank, for suggesting all of this. And Ram Dass?
Yeah.
Yes.
you were going to say?
I just say, I love this group. I love this group.
So do
we. Yeah, me too, you know.
Frank.
I'm aware at the moment of just my feeling such affection for the three of you as I sit here, and of course gratitude. And isn't it wonderful that we've kind of walked this trail together? And thank you for talking today and visiting, and always beautiful, Ram Dass, to be with you, especially. And we'll do this again next year, okay?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay. But you know, I also, Frank, want to thank you for doing this book. It's, you know, you caught many golden fish in the net of your experience. And it's just like a treasure house. Opening up this book and also listening to you reading the book is just absolutely fantastic. I'm just brought so much into your experience. Mm. And just, you know, going back to this notion of the five invitations, I think that's what Rilke was saying. Mm-hmm. Love and death are the great gifts that are given to us. Mostly they are passed on unopened. And, you know, this book is a key, if you will, for opening the gifts of love and death. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. This is Ram Dass's podcast, Here and Now. Thank you, Roshi Joan Halifax. You can also find Roshi's writing a new book, too, so we're going to get that sooner or later. And we won't talk about that. And thank you, Frank, and thank you, Ram Dass, and love you all. This podcast is brought to you by the Love Serve Remember Foundation and ramdass.org. We appreciate you listening, and we appreciate all the support that you've given us. Please continue that support and donate at ramdass.org. We can then continue to share what Ram Dass has been sharing for all of these years. Thank you.